name's Eric. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Eric. Hey, Eric.
Any drunks here tonight like me? How about dope fiends like me? Dope fiend drunk combos. My people. Well, it's been my honor to be the step speaker this month. And I was out of town last week, and I understand Greg R. did a good job covering for me, but only got through one step. Was anyone here last week? Is it true? Did he cover that one step, step four? I'll get even with him. So we want to try to get to 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, because next week we got to do 10, 11, and 12. So we got a lot to cover tonight. Had a little medical emergency on the back porch this evening when I was back there. One of the residents here had a seizure, and I wish everyone could have seen it. If you've never had a seizure, it's waiting for you on the alcoholic doom curve. And it's not something to be trifled with. You can die from a seizure, from cardiac arrest. And it's generally caused by too rapid a detox. That's why bad alcoholics need a medically supervised detox so their blood alcohol level doesn't fall too quickly and cause a seizure. But that's often complicated with benzodiazepines like Xanax and Valium. And benzo detoxes take quite a bit more care to avoid seizures. And this is what we're up against, a fatal illness that today kills 98% of the people who have it. Those aren't very good numbers. It's really true. There's cancers you can get today. You've got a much better chance of surviving than alcoholism. So the death rate in 1938 when this book was written was 98% for alcoholism. And the death rate today from alcoholism is 98%. Statistically, AA and CA and DAA and frickin' A are rounding errors to the world tide of alcoholism and drug addiction. We hadn't hardly put a dent in it, statistically. And in this country, where we have AA on every street corner, practically, 95% of the alcoholics in this country will never make it to one AA meeting. They'll just die of their alcoholism. And they'll die with the same question on their mind that I think every alcoholic has. I certainly had it. I spent a lot of time on a bar stool in this position, looking at you bastards. And that question is, why am I the smartest person I know whose life doesn't work? And they die. And they never get an answer and they never figure it out. So if you're in this room, I really want to emphasize how extraordinarily lucky you are to be in this room. You're in the top 5% of the alcoholics in this country. The problem is you got to be in the top 2% to survive, statistically speaking. And you might say, well, how the hell do I do that? And the answer is in this book. There really is a way out. There really is a way to be free. I'm a free man. I am a free man. I have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. And I've been a free man for a long time, ever since I got to step 10, 23 years ago. I've been a free man, and I haven't spent 1 second since that night trying to stay sober. For two reasons. One, it doesn't work, me trying to stay sober. Not for very long. And number two, I don't have to. The problem had been removed. It had been solved. It does not exist for me. And this book gives me a precise set of directions on how to keep it that way and to continue to grow and to live a full life, life in full, which includes a lot of fun. I have a lot of fun in life. Sobriety is not about fighting off alcohol one goddamn day at a time. That's what I thought it was when I got to AA 30 years ago. Just don't drink and go to meetings. And I thought, Jesus, if I could do that, I wouldn't be here. What do you mean, just don't drink and go to meetings? What the fuck does that mean? Well, don't drink if your ass falls off. Well, to date, my ass has never fallen off. Well, if your ass falls off, put it in the wheelbarrow, bring it to the meeting. What the fuck are you people talking about? That's what I heard when I got to AA. One old guy said, boy, you got a problem with alcohol? And I wanted to say, no, I don't. I have a problem with old, fat, gray-haired bastards like you. About like me now, I guess. That's what I wanted to say. I didn't say that. That's what I wanted to say. Because when I drink, I feel normal. When I drink, you bastards seem to straighten up quite a bit. When I drink, I get this tremendous relief. People say, relief from what? And I say, from everything and from everyone. It's almost a spiritual experience. It's not an accident they call booze sometimes spirits. Spirits. The alcoholic life was the only normal life I knew. When I drink, I feel like I belong on the planet. And if I have to stay dry very long, I feel like I'm landed on the wrong planet. And this is something much, much worse than a drinking problem. The world's full of people with a drinking problem or a substance abuse problem. And when a good enough reason comes along, they quit or they cut way back. A drinking problem is easily solved by quitting drinking. But every time I quit drinking, my life got worse. It became unbearable. It became so unbearable, someone was going to get seriously hurt. And I'd always have to drink again, just to keep from blowing into a million pieces. And once I start drinking, I have this abnormal reaction to alcohol. You know, I was 37 years old before I learned that for 90 out of 100 people in this country, the more they drink, the less they want every single time. Let me say that again. For 90 out of 100 people in this country, the more they drink, the less they want every single time. Anyone in here experience that? Yeah, look at that. We're in the elite 10%. The more I drink, the more I want. Every time. Didn't always drink more. It's hard to get that bottle up to your lips when your hands are handcuffed behind you. But I always wanted to drink more. And this is something quite different than an alcohol problem. This is a fatal illness called alcoholism. It kills. Graveyard dead. 98% of the people on this planet today who have this illness will die from it. And the death certificate may say drowning, it may say blunt force trauma, it may say 0.45 inch hole in the head, it may say seizure, it may say, you know, his liver ran out of the south end and down the inside of his pant leg. It may say a lot of things, but they're all alcoholic deaths. And it isn't one of those kumbaya deaths where your family's standing around the bed holding your hand. It's face down in your own puke. So this is step one. Step one's a son of a bitch. Alcoholism is the one mental illness we know of that tells the victim, you ain't got it. Not me. You don't understand. My case is different. That's what I said when I got to AA. I looked around the people in AA and I thought, Jesus, Jesus. AA may be fine for them, but not me. My case is different. You don't understand. My life gets worse when I quit drinking. They just kept talking about this problem with alcohol. So, we talked about, 2 weeks ago, we talked about the foreword of the first edition in this book, which tells us in the first sentence, it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous are more than 100 men and women who have recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. The voice in this book is the voice of these first 100. All through this book, wherever it says we, us, our, each other, they're not talking about the asshole in the meeting last week. They're talking about these first 100 who had recovered. So all through this book, where it says we, us, our, each other, they're referring to the first 100 who had recovered. The second sentence says, to show other alcoholics, which sort of raises a question. Could that be me? Nah. But it says, to show other alcoholics precisely how we have recovered is the main purpose of this book. So right up front, they tell us it's a precisely written book, and they're going to tell me, the reader, how they recovered. They're not going to tell me what to do. They're going to tell me what they did. What they did. They did certain things and they got certain results. Isn't that nice? I don't know about you, but a big portion of my life was spent with someone in front of me with a finger in my face. And here in this book, there's no finger in the face. They're just saying, here's what we did. And here's the result we got. Here's what we did, and here's the result we got. And it's so simple. This thing is so simple, and that's probably really the problem. Because alcoholics are all big brains, especially Brent and David. Just holding you up as poster children for big brain alcoholics. Most alcoholics are big brains. And they take something very, very simple and overthink it and completely wrap around the axle and say, ah, screw it. And they die. And this is why sponsorship is so important. A sponsor is just someone who points at things. Hey, did you notice your hair is on fire? What? A sponsor keeps you focused on this simple program rather than all the shit your mind makes up about this simple program. It's very simple. Now, I didn't believe any of this, but I was desperate. There was no other options left. I was going to die an alcoholic death. And I got a good sponsor. And I studied this book with my sponsor and I followed the directions, and it didn't take very long. In 2.5 months, I met him every Thursday night at 7 o'clock. In 2.5 months, I'm hanging on by my fingernails. In 2.5 months, I got to step 10 and discovered quite suddenly that my problem had been solved, that I was a free man, and that this power greater than me I really didn't know much about was in me, last damn place I ever would look. And I've been a free man, as I said, since that night. So it's very simple, and it doesn't take very long. But there's a precise set of directions. So in the doctor's opinion, which when this book came out in April of 1939, the first printing, first edition, the doctor's opinion up front was page 1. And unfortunately, some goddamn big brain alcoholic moved page 1 to chapter 1, Bill's story, in the second edition, and gave the doctor's opinion Roman numeral page numbers. Does anyone in here really remember how to read fucking Roman numerals? So no one reads the doctor's opinion anymore, because who has time for Roman numeral pages? You know, I got to go to the back and get the answer, right? It's got to be back here somewhere. Actually, it is. It's called Appendix 2. And this doctor, Dr. William Silkworth, who was interviewed when this book came out, And they said, Doc, how long have you been treating alcoholics and drug addicts? And he said, 38 years. And they said, how many have you treated? He said, I would estimate 40,000. And he said, well, how many of them recovered? And he said, again, I would estimate 2%. Now, he was trained as a medical doctor, a Princeton graduate, an Ivy League graduate, a medical doctor with 38 years experience across 40,000 patients, and he has an opinion based on that training and experience. And his opinion is this, that alcoholics suffer from two main things. Number one, an abnormal physical reaction to alcohol. The more we drink, the more we want, and that is not normal. 90 out of 100 people don't have that reaction. And there's sort of a part B to that. Alcohol does something for alcoholics like me. It doesn't do for normal drinkers. When I slam down the first few drinks, I get this tremendous, it's, like I said, it's almost spiritual. Normal drinkers do not get that. Which makes me wonder, why the hell do they even bother drinking? They drink a beer, you say, want another beer, Fred? Okay, give them the second beer. They drink half of it and let the other half go bad. And the next thing you know, they say, oh, gee, look at the time. I've got to work tomorrow. Why do you even bother, Fred? So alcohol does something for me it doesn't do for these normal drinkers. It makes me feel normal. Now, this physical allergy would not by itself doom alcoholics to an alcoholic death. It's a very simple thing to live a normal life fatally allergic to something. Everyone knows someone who's allergic to peanuts or shellfish. Their throat will swell shut and they'll die. It's an ER visit. You ever ask one of them how many Peanuts Anonymous meetings you've had to go to? How many Shellfish and Oysters Anonymous meetings do you go to a week? They'd all go, what? What the fuck are you talking about? They're like, look, I just don't get it on me or in me. I live a normal life. And get away from me, weirdo. So, being fatally allergic to alcohol is not enough to doom the alcoholic. Just don't get it on you or in you. But there's this second thing the doctor talks about. And he calls this a mental obsession for alcohol. Now, the word obsession means a persistent thought which will not respond to reason. A persistent thought which will not respond to reason. And it is this persistent thought that I'm going to figure it out. I'm going to figure out the right mix of cocaine, gin, and beer, and blondes, and chrome plate to live successfully. And I never did figure it out. I thought I'd figured it out. When I discovered cocaine, I said, this is great. If you do enough cocaine, you can drink all the gin you want and not fall down. Then pretty soon I had a cocaine problem and a gin problem. So this insane mental obsession, this obsession of the mind, that always takes alcoholics like me back to the first drink. It's these two things together, the abnormal physical reaction and the mental obsession. It's those two things together that kill the alcoholic. Now, as we've already sort of hinted at, if you're fatally allergic to something, you will always be fatally allergic to it. So in AA, we can't change that. If you've got the allergy, if the more you drink, the more you want, if you have that big red flag in your life, it's over. You will always have it. Which means that if we can't change the physical allergy, the only thing that can be changed is the insane mental obsession. I have to be rid of. The book's very precise. It doesn't say get rid of. If I could have gotten rid of it, I wouldn't need to go to AA. But it says I must be rid of this insane mental obsession. And that's what these 12 steps are all about. a spiritual program of simple actions sufficient to bring about the removal of the obsession of the mind. Well, I just don't like this God shit. We'll get to that in a minute. So the doctor's opinion lays out the problem, an allergy of the body, an obsession of the mind. If you're going to solve a problem, it helps to know what the problem is. The problem never was alcohol. The problem never was heroin. The problem never was cocaine. The problem never was meth. They all sure look like the problem, but they never were the real problem. All they are symptoms of something much worse called alcoholism or drug addiction. So he lays out the problem. But he was a scientific man. And he was humble enough to say, look, I've always known something more than science was needed for the alcoholic. I don't know what it is, and I don't know how to apply it. Very humble man to admit that. And so the whole rest of the book is, well, what is this thing? What is this solution? So in chapters 1, 2, and 3, they give example after example after example of alcoholism. Okay? This abnormal physical reaction, this obsession of the mind. They give example after example of the obsession picking up the first drink, and then once the first drink is in the body, the physical craving kicking in and picking up drinks 2 through 20. They give example after example after example of that, hoping just one of them lands on you, the reader, where you can say, oh, that's me. I did that. I'm like that. I act that way. I think that way. I feel that way. And then we get to chapter 4, We Agnostics, which I talked about 2 weeks ago. We get to page 47 in chapter 4. We Agnostics, if you weren't here, the word agnostic from the Latin gno, to grow, to know. A meaning not. So we not knows. We not know what? Not know anything about God. And at page 47, these first 100 who wrote this book say, do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from honestly asking yourself what these things mean to you. So my sponsor, Bill, said, that's an action. And I said, what I often said to Bill, of course, what? And he said, that's an action. When you peel it all back, Eric, I know you can give me a 3-hour lecture on all the shit you don't believe about God. They're not asking that. They're asking here on page 47 in the summer of 1995, what is it you do believe? What do you believe? What does all this spiritual God stuff mean to you? And I hadn't looked at that question, I think, since I was probably 5 years old. When I was 5 years old, I had a God I loved, I presume loved me, and I was happy. And by the age of 10 or 12, the God they put on me was such that I had said, well, who needs a God like that? I'll do it myself. And I launched me and my big brain against the world. And I lived that way until it just about killed me at the age of 37. And so here at the age of 37, they're asking me to honestly ask myself, what do you believe? So the next Thursday night, we read, my sponsor would give me a reading assignment. I would read it, and then we would meet, and he would read it to me out loud, the whole thing. So he's reading chapter 4, we get to page 47, and we get to that question, and he says, what's your answer? And I said, well, I believe that God created the universe, and then he went away. And Bill said, well, that's fine. Because the next sentence says, at the start, page 47, at the start, that's where you are, Eric, he said, at the start, this, your own starting place, this is all we needed to commence. Commence means begin, Eric. To commence spiritual growth, to affect our first conscious. Conscious means you will know it. Conscious relationship with God as you understand. Now, this was quite a milestone for me. All my life, when anyone talked to me about God, they had a finger in my face, and I had a finger for them. And I couldn't understand what the hell they were talking about. It was just a lot of blood and dead animals, that's for sure. And here on page 47, here's 100 adults. It's weird. At 37, I didn't see myself as an adult. 100 adults plus my sponsor. 101 adults giving me permission to start where I was on this whole God business. First time in my life. And if you give it more than about 10 seconds of thought, you realize, well, that's the only place anyone could ever start. I tried like hell to start where Billy Graham was, because I knew he believed everything he was pitching. But I couldn't understand a thing he was talking about. In fact, it was intellectually offensive to me. And here on page 47, here's 101 adults saying, look, let's just set Billy Graham aside, and let's just start where you are, whatever that honestly is. And this changed the course of my life. Now, in chapter 5, we get to page 62, and they presented me with a brand new idea. And it says on page 62, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we believe is the root of our troubles, driven by means no choice. You have no choice in the matter. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and retaliate. Now, this was a brand new idea to me. Because when I got to AA, I was convinced it was your fault. I was convinced that it was you bastards who kept jacking with me, and someone's going to get hurt if I don't get a drink. I get a few drinks, maybe I won't have to shoot you. Bastard. And here's this brand new idea. It ain't them. And my sponsor said, look, Eric, if it really is them, you're doomed. Probably used a different word. You're doomed. You don't have the power to change all of them. But if you can see that the problem is in your own mind, now you've got a chance because there's these steps you can take. That was a brand new idea. It ain't them. And that was somehow the good news. You see, the way this universe operates is in the following order. Thought, word, deed. That's the way everything works in this whole universe. Thought, word, deed. If my thinking is driven by 100 forms of self-centered fear, my words and my deeds are going to reflect that. And what's going to show up in my life is what I sometimes call the shit truck. In the old days, we called it a honey wagon. No one seems to know what a frickin' honey wagon is anymore. It's what they pump out. It's a big tanker truck. They pump out septic systems. So it's a tanker truck full, literally, of shit. And that's what used to be parked in my driveway at 6 a.m. waiting for me when I got up. And I couldn't understand it. Why am I the smartest person I know whose life just doesn't fucking work? Every morning at 6 a.m., that driver would be there. Morning, Mr. Beebe. Jump right in. Have a nice day. Day after day after day. And if I don't get some relief, someone's going to get hurt. And it's because of my thinking back then. I was driven by 100 forms of self-centered fear, which caused me to think, say, and do things that you people didn't react to very nicely. You know, like when I'd steal your dope and then help you look for it. That's a little laugh line. So I'm going to drink a coffee. Now, shortly after that, they asked me to make a decision, which is step three. Step three is very, very simple. It's a decision. It's a decision. Step one is an admission. I'm doomed. I have this physical allergy to alcohol. The more I drink, the more I want. I can't stop once I start. And I have this something wrong with my head that always takes me back to the first drink and then rinse and repeat until I die. So, yeah, I got this thing called alcoholism, and by studying the foreword of the first edition of The Doctor's Opinion in the first three chapters, I get it. That's me. I have this thing called alcoholism. Step two is, can I be open to the idea, can I be open to a power greater than me helping me? Can I just be open to that? And on page 47 in chapter 4, I found my very own starting place on this God thing. When people say, well, I just don't like this God shit. I'm like, dude, would you read the fucking book? It's very simple. We're asking you to start where you are. There's no one in AA here to tell you where to start with God. We're just saying start. We're telling you to shut up and stop saying no. Start fucking saying yes. What? Sorry for my language, I get a little emotive at times. So step three is a decision. Am I in or am I out? Which is it? Very simple. We made a decision. We made a decision. I made a decision to turn to this power greater than me I really knew very little about for help. That's it. And because of step one, I'm doomed. Sign me up. I'm in. I'm in. Now, don't confuse deciding to be in with demonstrating that decision to be in. Demonstrating that decision is a whole other topic. And that's what the rest of the steps are about. In step three, I'm only making a decision. Greatest decision I ever made in my life. Most important decision I ever made in my life. You know what they said to me 30 years ago when I got to AA? No major decisions your first year. Really? Really? That would have killed me in 1995. Yeah, a major decision. Very simple, though. Are you in or are you out? Which is it? And then, right into step four. Now, Greg apparently spent a whole hour on step four, so I'm going to blow through it. But in step four, they say it is a fact-finding and a fact-facing process. This is not a beat-the-shit-out-of-you process. You hear people in meetings, oh, step four, oh, it's just terrible. Shut up! That's not what the book says. It's a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It turns out, in step four, I'm trying to find out the truth about page 62 in my life. Page 62 said selfishness, self-centeredness, that we believe is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of self-centered fear. I'm trying to find the truth of that in my life. Is that true in my life? That's step four. Now they have me do a resentment inventory, a fear inventory, a sex inventory, which isn't really about sex, a sane and sound ideal for my future sex life, which isn't really about sex, and then a list of people I've hurt. My sponsor said, there isn't anything you can tell me about your sex life I don't have of me doing on film. And he was telling the truth. He's a hippie from the 60s. They filmed all those Mazzola parties on Super 8. He said, I don't care about that leather and Vaseline thing you got going on. That's not what this sex inventory is about. There's a series of precise questions in the chapter. The first column is, whom had I hurt in that area of life? Whom had I hurt? Didn't say who did I sleep with or how many. Whom had I hurt in that area of life? Where had I been selfish, dishonest, or inconsiderate? Did I unjustifiably arouse jealousy, suspicion, or bitterness? Where was I at fault? What should I have done instead? That's what we're after. A fact-finding and a fact-facing process. So in this step four, I came to see the truth about page 62 in my life. My whole life, all the drama in my life, I'll say 98% of the drama in my life, 2% slush factor. 98% of the drama in my life, I set it in motion. My selfishness, my fear, my dishonesty caused me to think, say, and do things that ended in disaster. And there it was in my own handwriting. Bill said, that is your handwriting, isn't it? Fuck. Look out, it's a trap. Now, I've sponsored hundreds of people in 23 years, and I ask every one of them, when you subtract all the time you spent looking for a pen and all the time you spent going to CVS for a spiral notebook and all the time on the phone with your girlfriend and having to stop, you got to watch that Seinfeld rerun, it's the Soup Nuts, you got to watch that. When you subtract all that shit, how much time did it actually take to write step four? And the average answer is, across hundreds of sponsees, 2 hours. Now there's some that are longer, there's some that are a little shorter. The average answer is 2 hours. So this bullshit about taking 6 months to write a four-step is bullshit. It is a death sentence for alcoholics. And any sponsor that says, yep, just read chapter five, go write your four-step, and call me when you're done. Get a new sponsor. Step four is pretty simple, but we can't swallow it all. We have to break it into pieces. That's where a sponsor comes in. It takes about 10 days to do a four-step, to write it down. It takes about 10 days to get 2 hours of writing done for most alcoholics. Again, there's a few exceptions like Brent. Who I dearly love. So in step five, I share all this with my sponsor, and anything that wasn't clear about the truth about page 62 in my life, he helped me get clear on. And there it was. I was the author of my own life. It wasn't you bastards after all. And this was good news. This was good news, turns out. Now in step six and seven, six kind of looks like a filler step, doesn't it? We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. The book gives it, I think, is it two paragraphs or one? One paragraph, page 76. But six is a pivotal step because we spend a lot of time in life getting ready. You get ready to go out, you get ready to take a shower, you get ready to go to work. Get ready to go to bed. Six is about being ready. Am I really ready to let this power greater than my big brain that I don't really understand in on the whole deal called Eric? Am I really ready to do that? That's a big step. And many alcoholics get drunk right there because their big brain says, wait a minute. Looking at you. Wait a minute. I see where this is going. I, big brain, won't be running things anymore. You may be overreacting. Let's get a drink and think about this. And then get drunk. Makes sense to me. But I was desperate. I was at the end. It was over for me. I was hopeless. I was doomed. My only hope was that something would happen with these steps. I knew if nothing happened taking these steps, and again, I didn't believe anything would happen. I was just out of options. I knew if nothing happened, I was a dead man. So I was ready. I was ready. In step seven, I had to get on my knees at the biker club where I sobered up and hold my sponsor's hand and say the seven-step prayer in our book out loud, course, I was hoping no bikers would come in, seeing me on my knees, holding a man's hand, for Christ's sake, praying out loud. But I meant it. In this beautiful seven-step prayer, my Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, the good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength to do your bidding as I go out from here. Amen. Now, what were these defects of character or shortcomings? By the way, those two are the same things. Bill Wilson, who wrote this, just didn't want defects of character and short. He didn't want the same word next to each other at the end of a sentence. So he wrote defects of character here and shortcomings here. They mean the same thing. How do I know that? Because Chuck Chamberlain freaking asked him, what's the difference? And Bill told him, there ain't any. What are these shortcomings? Well, at the highest level, what I learned in step 4 and 5 is selfishness, dishonesty, and fear. But selfishness, dishonesty, and fear have these colorful children. Selfishness, dishonesty, and fear will manifest in my life as these colorful children, which a certain church has very kindly listed for me hundreds of years ago. And these colorful children are named things like pride and envy and lust and greed and sloth and avarice and anger, which we call resentment. So, defects of character, yeah, it's these colorful children. Greed and lust probably tied for first with me. But behind it all is this selfishness, this dishonesty, and this fear. That's the root of my trouble. So in 7, I ask God to remove that. To remove selfishness, dishonesty, and fear in all of its colorful children. And I meant it. And I meant it. I remember 20 years ago, they were still having AA meetings where the chairman is headed. Tonight's topic, working on our character defects. And I just wanted to burst out laughing. If I could work on my character defects with my big brain and get anywhere, I wouldn't be in this fucking place, I'll tell you what. That is the stupidest thing I've ever heard in AA. Working on my character defects. It's going to take a power greater than me, power greater than my big brain, to remove these character defects. So forget about working on them. Forget about it. I just got back from New York. Let me practice on you. Forget about it. I'm telling you, forget about it. It's a waste of time. If we could work on these things and get anywhere, we wouldn't need God or AA or anything else. They have to be removed, and it's only a power greater than my big brain that can remove them. Now, my part is to dig my fingernails out of them, to let go of it. And sometimes that's a tedious process. But there ain't no working on character defects. God's going to remove them or he's not. And that's just the way it is. So, holy cow, I may pull this off. I got up from that 7-step prayer, very happy that no bikers came in, seeing me hold the man's hand on my knees, praying out loud. But I meant it. And my sponsor, Bill, looked down at me and said, well, gives me chills. He said, fasten your seatbelt because now you've asked. What I wanted to say, what the fuck does that mean, Bill? That's what I wanted to say. But I didn't say anything. And right into steps 8 and 9. Now, in our book, it says, let's look at steps 8 and 9. Our book treats steps 8 and 9 together. But in my experience, 8 is 90% of the 8 and 9 equation. Because 8 is all about willingness. Am I really willing to go out into the world and try to clean up this mess I've made? I really willing to do that? If I'm willing to do that, 9 is pretty academic. 9 is the act of going to someone and saying, I was wrong to have harmed you by fill in the blank. Now, that's not easy for an alcoholic to say, is it? I was wrong to have harmed you by. So I had my list of people I hurt from that I made back in step 4, and in step 8, Bill and I went through each and every person on my list, and we discussed each one. The first question from him was, well, how did you hurt Fred? And, you know, I might say, well, I told him that his wife was a bitch. He says, Eric, we don't have time for everyone you are a dickhead to. This is supposed to be a list of people you hurt. Now, how did you hurt Fred? Well, that was it. All right, scratch Fred off. Who's next? So we went through, and a few got scratched off. And we discussed, what is the amend? The word amend means to change. You know, there's an amend. We talk about amendments to the U.S. Constitution. That means a change to the United States Constitution. The word amend means to change. Okay, so what's the change that has to take place with Joe? Well, I stole his dope and then helped him look for it. Okay, well, how much dope was it? Well, it was only an ounce. An ounce of what? Well, it was only an ounce of cocaine. All right, so what's an ounce of cocaine go for today? I said, fuck, I don't know. He said, well, find out, and you need to go pay Joe for an ounce of cocaine. And we discussed each one. And some amends required a letter. It says some people cannot be seen. We send them an honest letter. There were some dead people. I couldn't make amends because they were dead. And Bill said, you're going to write them a letter and you're going to read it to me. And you're going to read it to me as if they're standing right behind me. And he said, you got 2 weeks to make your amends. 2 weeks. I'm telling you, folks, this is a simple deal. I had a pretty good list. I probably had about 25 amends to make. And I owed a lot of money. I didn't have any money. I owed a lot of money. That didn't make any difference. I had to go tell them I owe you the money. I was wrong to have not paid you back, or I was wrong to have stolen this, or whatever it was. I don't have any money now, but I owe you the money. And I'm going to pay you. So not having any money is no bearing on it. I was wrong to have harmed you by. So he gave me 2 weeks, and I had amends in Colorado. I was living there at the time. I had amends in Colorado. In Texas, a lot of amends. I had amends in New York and Kansas. And I did it. And at the end of 2 weeks, he had said, now read page 84 and 85 on step 10. We'll cover it on Thursday when we meet. And I'm going to, next week, I'm going to do kind of a deep dive in 10, 11, and 12, especially step 10. But the thing I want to leave you with is my favorite part of the book called the Step 10 Promises. You know, they got 12. This is bullshit. There are not 12 promises in the book. There are dozens and dozens and dozens of promises in the book. That is bullshit. Those are the 12 ninth step promises. This is the promises from step 9. Every step in this book has promises. And there's no free promises, by the way. Every promise next to, before or after, every promise in this book is lurking a requirement. Something I have to do. There's no free lunch in this deal. Okay? So I'm just telling you, this is complete horseshit. Okay? And I'm going to read you the best promises in this book, which are the step 10 promises. This is nothing. Now listen to this. It's Thursday night, and Bill's reading me page 84, starting with, "This thought brings us to step 10. And I'm going to skip down to the bottom where it says, the step 10 promises start. It says, "And we have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, for by this time," step 10, "sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally. We will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That is the miracle of it. We are not fighting it. Neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we've been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It does not exist for us." Remember, the us is the first 100. "We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. That is how we react so long as we keep in fit spiritual condition." And I burst out crying, because I suddenly realized that that had happened to me. I don't know when it happened, but I realized that it happened that Thursday night when Bill read it to me. I'd read my assignment. I'd already read that. But when he read it to me, I suddenly realized that that had happened to me. This insane mental obsession I'd had for alcohol for so many years, I couldn't remember not having it. It was gone. It was just gone. All the voices in my head were gone. The noise in my head was gone, and I was a free man. Now, doesn't that blow away these nine-step promises? It does for me. And in the next moment, I had the certain, sudden realization of God in me. God in me. The last damn place I ever would have looked. And I was bawling my eyes out. And I've been a free man ever since that night, 23 years ago. This is what we're talking about in AA, is freedom. Freedom. The problem has been removed. It does not exist for us. This is an astonishing thing. This is an astonishing thing. I came down here tonight to tell everyone in this room that there is a way out. There is a way to be free. There is a way, it requires a little open-mindedness, there is a way to be sober and happy. I know that may sound impossible. It sounded impossible to me. This thing is absolutely astonishing. So next week we'll go back, we'll do step 10 again, and then 11 and 12, and then you'll get some new guy next month. God bless him. Thank you.